And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Great to be back behind the microphone with you today. Maybe gloomy out there, but just remember the days are getting longer as we progress through the year. Just getting back in Vermont, and as you all know, I attended the burial ceremonies at Arlington National Cemetery of my friend Tim Holden, and what a ceremony that was. There was the funeral procession that came through the streets of Washington. It was accompanied by about 300 bicyclists that were leading the hearse that was coming through, had police escort. They shut down the streets. He went into Arlington. The crowds trying to get into Arlington were tremendous. They had to hold up the burial services because there were so many people that were trying to get in. And as you remember, he was struck down by a car, or as I have mentioned before, he was struck down by a car while riding his bicycle in the D.C. area. The Washington Post covered these burial ceremonies. Every TV station in D.C. covered these burial ceremonies. And what I was struck by is some of the quotes that came out of the Washington Post the next morning in their article. And it was a fairly lengthy article about Tim Holden, his life, his burial, friends that were talking about him. And one of the quotes that I thought was particularly good was Jim Donnelly, who was a friend of his, a bicyclist friend of his. Tim Holden was an avid bicycler, and he said, "Tim was a person who, even if you were not a friend, he always had your back. He was very religious, very athletic, very humble. The first words out of his mouth were always things about you, not about him." And I thought that summed it up in the Washington Post article about Tim Holden's burial on Friday. It's good to be back. It's good to be back in the state. One of the things, as I was just walking in here to do the program this morning, is I just saw this, and this is great news, actually, for the city of Montpelier, that the Vermont Mountaineers, the baseball team, the professional baseball team, will continue to call Montpelier Recreation Field home through at least the 2036 season. That means that the Vermont Mountaineers are an institution here in this area. And congrats to Mountaineer General Manager Brian Gallagher and Montpelier Mayor John Holler for doing this. I think this is a wonderful, wonderful thing that's happening to the area. And being an institution, I mean, this baseball team being an institution is something to be proud of. And Tom, we need to get Brian Gallagher and John Holler on the program to talk about this, because this is a big deal.
Yes, it is.
So if we can note that down and get
absolutely
and get them on the phone, I certainly would appreciate it. And just a plug for them, because I'm always amazed when I read this in terms of ticket sales. When you go to the Red Sox or you go to other baseball games, it is the price shock is amazing. But Mountaineer season tickets are now on sale and good for all of the 22 regular season games as well as the playoff games. And get this, the ticket prices for students, $50. For seniors, $50 for students and seniors, $75 for adults, and $130 for a family of four. And boy, that's reasonable. Congratulations to the city of Montpelier. Congratulations to the Vermont Mountaineers. Great, great news that they'll be around to the 2036 season at Montpelier Recreation Field. Today's show, great show that we have lined up today. Liz Miller, former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin. It's a busy, many people don't know this, but this is a very, very busy time of year on the fifth floor. What is happening on the fifth floor right now is are lots of things going on that we will talk about with Liz Miller, the former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin, and then Bob Ney. Many of you know Bob. He's a former congressman from Ohio. Calls in for Talk Media News on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And we talk about different subjects, mostly about Congress, political things that are going on. But he was a former congressman, and I want to get his experiences in Congress. I want to know why, and many of you may or may not know this, he was convicted and spent jail time for some bribery charges. And I want to talk about his involvement in the Abramoff scandal during those times. So we'll talk with Bob Ney, former congressman. And then we'll talk with Lisa Grady of the Stowe Public Library. She'll be in studio. And we'll talk about the upcoming events at the library. But first, since it has been a few days since we chatted, I wanted to open up the phone lines for your calls. We didn't, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot that's been happening. Looking at the news this morning, for example, Bruce Lissman, Republican candidate for governor, has disclosed that his net worth is $51 million. First of all, kudos to him for his disclosure. Not a lot of politicians nowadays give the specific amounts, especially in Congress, whether you're in the Senate or in the House, it's a range. So kudos to him for doing that. But does this make a difference, in your opinion, of Bruce Lissman? Does it make a difference on whether you'll be attracted to his candidacy, or does it put you off his wealth at $51 million? Is it important to you that he has been successful in business? And we must remember that he did come from modest means growing up in Burlington. He's self-made. Grew up in the Burlington school system. His parents were typical middle class. He went to UVM and then became successful. So he didn't grow up with a silver spoon in his mouth as Donald Trump did. And if you have a problem with his wealth, is it fair? Because he's been successful. His opponent, Phil Scott, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, has promised to release his financials as well. I think he said that he would release them after he files his taxes in April. So what is your opinion? Does his wealth hurt? Does his wealth hurt him and his candidacy? Does it make a difference in your eyes? Or is it no big deal? Give us a call at our WDEV studios if you have an opinion. 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. So does it, Bruce Lissman's wealth, does it have an influence on what you think of him as a candidate or his attractiveness as a candidate to you? And also, I was just thinking, as I was traveling back from D.C., this is the time of year that you sort of reflect. You reflect about your life. You reflect about your service. You reflect about your life. You reflect about your future, not your service, as you get ready for the new year. And as we reminisce about our lives, sometimes we discover it's the little things that can make a difference. And I was thinking about that and thinking about those little things that do make a difference. I mean, we've all heard the phrase, don't sweat the small stuff, but nevertheless in life, little things do make a big difference in our lives. So what are those little things? I'll talk about those in a minute, but for example, people enter our lives and leave so quickly that we barely remember them. But that brief encounter becomes part of you. And we all have our stories about those people. For example, when I was about 8 years old, Walter Pierce was a talented 10-year-old baseball player in Ludlow, Vermont. And the thing about Walter Pierce that always amazed me, he could pitch a baseball with either arm at equal velocity. I think he would have been prime in those days for the Vermont Mountaineers. he had a gift for understanding the game. And even though he was 10 years old, he taught me. He spent hours teaching me how to play the game. And it was through that experience that I became active in sports. I only knew him for a summer, and I haven't seen him since, but he made a big difference in my life. These small things making big differences in your life. I mean, three friends in Ludlow taught me the art of friendship, Joey Albano, Chucky Zenowich, and Jimmy Lannon. We did almost everything together in grade school until I moved away, and we lost touch after that. I discovered recently that Jimmy Lannon passed away, but they touched the life as well, my life as well, in learning the art of friendship. And then when I lived and worked in Hardwick for a brief period, I met a brilliant and modest man who taught me about the fact that formal education does open doors, but an open mind is what defines intelligence. He only had an eighth grade education. And he left school early to work for the family and to support his family. So he taught me that brilliance doesn't necessarily come from education. So many people influence us in our lifetime. Be curious to hear from you who influences you. We talked about Bruce Lisman's wealth. Does that make a difference in his candidacy? We're talking about people who make a difference in our lives. Those small encounters, those tiny encounters that we barely remember making a difference in our lives. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone line to Whit in South Carolina. Good morning, Whit.
Well, good morning, Michael. I hope you had a great trip down south.
It was colder in D.C. than it was here, by the way.
I'm finding that Burlington, Vermont has a lot of flights out of Burlington I never knew existed. I went to the internet this morning and I see a flight out of Burlington that goes to Atlanta, Georgia every day. I didn't know that even existed.
Yeah, and now they have a direct flight to Charlotte as well.
Yeah, that's right. But the business flight is over $2,000. You got to get an economy seat on that, because I've looked at that as a means of shuttling myself up to Vermont.
Yeah, that's a hefty price.
It is a hefty price. But again, you talk about Bruce Lisman. I'm going to say this. I'm sort of tired, and by the way, don't take this personal, because I don't think you will. But anyway, I am tired of millionaires and billionaires being called successful. I mean, pirates can be successful, too. How much loot have you got? It seems incredible to me that Bruce Lisman could ever amass $60 million in any fair way whatsoever. And because he can play down on Wall Street and make $1 million or $3 million in one transaction in an afternoon, does that make him successful? I just don't like the word success used because somebody has $1 million in the bank. And $1 million today, obviously, it's not worth what it used to be because people have homes that are worth $1 million. But again, my criticism, if it's really a criticism, is it's not against you. It's just that I hear these people that want to support and apologize for wealth, saying, well, they're more successful than you are, and you're just jealous. That's what you are, Whit. You're jealous. You don't have $10 million. And that's the problem I have with people using success and equating it immediately with somebody that's incredibly wealthy.
Well, thanks, Whit. I appreciate your phone call. We're talking, that's Whit's perspective, talking about Bruce Lisman, who's a Republican candidate for governor. He's disclosed that his net worth is $51 million. What we're asking this morning, does that matter? Like I said, kudos to him for disclosure, because a lot of people don't disclose the specific amount of their wealth. A lot of people do, but in Congress you don't have to. You can do a range. So kudos to him for that. But does it make a difference in how you view your opinion, in either your view or your opinion of Bruce Lisman? Does it make you more attracted to his candidacy, or does it put you off? And again, he grew up with modest means in Burlington, Vermont, went to the Burlington school system, attended UVM and then went and was a person that worked for Bear Stearns in New York City. So just interested in your opinion. His opponent has promised to release his financials as well. I think after he files, that's Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, after he files his taxes in April. So what's your opinion? Does this worth hurt his candidacy? That's Bruce Lisman we're talking about, and his net worth is $51 million. So does his wealth hurt him in your eyes, or is it no big deal? Welcome your phone calls at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. And also talking about those little things in life, those little encounters in life that change the way that it changes our future. So life, these little things, these little relationships that we have, these moments, these lessons that we have, change our life forever. And I talked about Walter Pierce, who was a 10-year-old that taught me everything about baseball, got me involved in sports. And he lived in a small apartment with his mother, and they had little money. But boy, he had a heart of gold. And even though we only spent one summer together, and I haven't seen him since, he made a big difference. And that brief encounter made a brief difference. So interested in your thoughts, your opinions. Bruce Lisman, does wealth make a difference in how you view a political candidate? And certainly it hasn't at the presidential level, because most of the front runners are very wealthy. So wondering about, does wealth make a difference in how you view a political candidate? And those small things that made a difference in your life. Give us a call at our WDEV studios, 802-244-1777, or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic.
Hi, how you doing today?
Great. How are you, sir?
I'm kind of taken back by the last caller. This country is built on capitalism, and man earned a dollar, and that's how he earned his dollar. Does that make him successful? I don't know. Well, success can be taken in many ways. You know, how many friends you have, you know, your quality of life, you know, does that success? I'm not sure. But you can't make him a criminal because he earned money. I mean, let's look at the Clintons. How much money they have, and how did they earn their money? You know, they're selling cows for $10 billion each back in the day. You know, same thing with Bernie Sanders when he was going up against Karen. And Karen says, let's not go there, you know? Mm-hmm. These people all made it in the public sector. They made their money. At least he had the common decency to earn this in the private sector.
Good point, Sam. Thank you very much for your phone call. I really appreciate it. Two different perspectives, one from Whit, one from Sam, in terms of how do we define success? Success can be defined many ways, as Sam said, and one of the ways is monetary, in terms of we're talking about Bruce Lisman today, disclosing the fact that his net worth is $51 million. Should that be a liability, or should that be an asset when people are running for political office? So let's go back to the phone lines. If you want to call us, give us a call at our WDEV studios, 802-244-1777, or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Jim in Brookfield. Jim, you're on open mic.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good job on your show, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much, Jim.
I've been self-employed for 45 years. And probably 99% of my work is from people that are successful. And I can only respect them. Most of them come up the hard way and earn what they have. And that's the way I look at them. Thank goodness for them, because they've fed me all these years.
Great perspective.
And one other thing, that you talk about people that change your lives. You know, I just have a high school education, but I've been lucky. I've been successful in construction all these years, but I say my parents gave me the gift of poverty. I was the oldest of five boys. My dad was a mechanic. We didn't have much, but that shaped my life. And the person in my life who shaped me most is probably my football coach, because he taught me that I could dig deeper than I ever thought I could. So I'll leave you with that, and you have a Merry Christmas.
A Merry Christmas, Jim, and thank you so much for that perspective. That Jim talked about successful people making him successful because they buy his services or products, and the person that had an influence on his life was his football coach, and those little encounters that we talk about. And that's what we're talking about for the next few minutes on Open Mic. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. We're talking about, does wealth make a difference in how you view a candidate, whether for governor, for president? Bruce Lisman has just released his net worth. He's worth $51 million. Does that make a difference in how you view him and his candidacy, for good or bad? Give us a call. And second, those little encounters in life, have you had them? Mostly there are people, for example, who enter our life so quickly and leave so quickly that we barely even remember them. But that brief encounter becomes a part of you. And we all have those stories. I talked about Walter Pierce. Jim talked about his football coach. I talked about the friendship that I had in grade school and how it was lost, but the art of friendship, knowing how to compromise, knowing how to get along, those sort of things stay with you for a long time. My aunt, for example, who died when I was in elementary school, in the brief time I knew her, she instilled in me a deep sense of spirituality that only became apparent to me when I grew older. So many people will influence our life, and those brief and sometimes chance encounters have an equally lasting and important impact in how we live our lives as these relationships develop, as equal as those relationships we develop for the long term. So be interested. Does Bruce Lisman's wealth at $51 million influence how you view him? Or can you give us a call on those little instances that have changed your life? The number to call if you wish to join the conversation is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. And just a brief reminder here, and it's really, really good news, is that the Vermont Mountaineers are staying put in Montpelier to at least the 2036 season. And that means they're an institution here in Vermont. And congrats to the Mountaineers and General Manager Brian Gallagher, and congrats to Montpelier Mayor John Holler. This is pretty darn important. I mean, they become an institution now for the city of Montpelier. And I think, and they've been a fine tradition, and they will continue to be a fine tradition, but they are an institution now. Let's go back to the phone lines and talk to Dave in Virgins. Dave, you're on Open Mic.
Hey, Mike, how are you doing this morning?
Great, thank you.
Are we still talking about Mr. Lisman?
We certainly are. We're talking about anything you want to talk about, Dave.
Well, I will just say, you know, I hung up, or I shut my radio off for a minute. I know before somebody was saying something about success, whether money's a success or not. And everybody has their own value system about success. What makes somebody successful? I've seen poor people who raised a wonderful family, and I would have considered them a success. But what should matter with Mr. Lisman, or for people with Mr. Lisman, is he's made a lot of money, and he's made a commitment to stay in Vermont, despite the fact that a lot of wealthy people, I'm sure he's had accountants tell him, oh, you could pay less taxes somewhere else, and he's still here. And he's made investments in Vermont and certain things, and I think that speaks volumes about his character and his commitment to the state.
Hey, Dave, I really appreciate your perspective. That's a good perspective. Merry Christmas, Dave. And coming up, Liz Miller, former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin, and we'll talk about the fact that it's a busy time of year on the fifth floor being the governor's office, the secretary of administration's office, and the budget office. And we'll talk about what's happening on the fifth floor this time of year. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in our Radio Vermont studios Liz Miller, former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin. It's a busy, not many people know this, but it's an extremely busy time of year for the fifth floor. And I asked Liz to come in and talk about what's going on. She's obviously no longer the chief of staff to the governor, so she doesn't know specifically what's going on. But generally, what goes on on that fifth floor? And the fifth floor has the governor's office, the secretary of administration's office, and the budget office. What goes on this time of year? And it's very, very busy time of year for them. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. I have the time to be here because I'm no longer on the fifth floor.
And we'll get into that because I want to talk about changes. And when you leave the fifth floor, what sort of happens to you when that happens? Because, you know, some people have different experiences because you're in the middle of everything and then you're not in the middle of everything. And
right.
So I want to talk about that in a little while. But just briefly, Liz, if you could just give us a little bit about your background before you became chief of staff.
Sure. Well, actually, I spent years in the private sector. I'm a lawyer by training. And I came to Vermont first, right out of law school. I worked down in Brattleboro for a year after law school for a great guy, Jim Oakes. He was a federal judge down there. And I just loved Vermont. Thought about staying at the time, but felt the pull to go back home to California for a few years. So I did that. But then, you know, thinking about life and what I wanted in the longer term and what my husband wanted, we really wanted to be somewhere smaller where we could make more of an impact, have more of a rural life. And we knew we loved Vermont, so we made the choice to come back. That was in the late 90s, and I joined a law firm in Burlington first, and then struck out on my own, had my own law firm for about a decade. And then I had the opportunity when Governor Shumlin was elected to join his cabinet. I first was his Commissioner of Public Service at the Department of Public Service, did that for 2 years, and then he asked me to become his Chief of Staff, which was an amazing opportunity. You know that from working directly with the governor on the fifth floor. So I couldn't pass that opportunity up and did that for him for 2.5 years and left last May.
Now, do you have an arrangement with your husband where one is in public service while the other is not? Because your husband is Eric Miller, who is the U.S. attorney for Vermont. Is there an arrangement here?
Not at all. But, you know, it was interesting. I think he saw the way that my life developed when I was in public service, and he had always wanted to do a stint in public service himself, and the opportunity to become the U.S. Attorney for Vermont came up for him, and he was very fortunate to get it. He loves the job. It's, I think, incredibly rewarding, so I'm really glad that he's having the opportunity to do that.
He beat you in here, by the way. He was on this show. Not many people realize how busy of a time of year, perhaps even the busiest time of year, other than the end of the legislative session. This is one of the busiest times of year for the fifth floor. Can you explain what's going on all at once?
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me, I was listening as I came into the studio, you were talking about the Mountaineers. And really, the sports analogy is probably the best one for people who've never been involved in state government directly. You've got your training camp, you have your preseason, then you go through the season, the playoffs, and the championship. And state government has a rhythm that matches that in many ways. You know, we think of January 1st as sort of the beginning of the year, obviously, on our calendar, and many of us in our lives, our rhythms sort of fit that. But state government, January is really the beginning of the season, and there's been a lot that's happened before the season in terms of the training camp and the preseason. And so really, when you think about this time of year for state government, it's been a lot of buildup since last May when the legislature concluded to first wrap up from that session, figure out what reports and research need to be done, then build your priorities for the coming year, which feeds directly into your budget. The budget usually, the process gets started back in the summertime. And the secretaries and commissioners have been working really hard with all of their staff to come up with budget recommendations for the governor's office. The Secretary of Administration has been doing a ton of work on that and has been working very closely with the cabinet since probably September. And they're just about to present the final recommendations to the governor, probably right about now, this week or next. And then once the governor has signed off on the key aspects of the budget, they'll build the budget speech, which will be kind of mid-January, about a week or two after the State of the State, and then we're off. So really, the work leading up to January is critically important. January, when the legislature comes back, the team has to be ready to take the field, as it were, but there's a lot of work that comes about before that.
There's the budget, of course. There's the legislative agenda, of course, and then there's two speeches, the State of the State speech and the budget speech. How does that all get done?
Well, a lot of sleepless nights for staff. It is a busy time of year, particularly with the two speeches, which traditionally set the tone, not just for the legislative agenda for the year, but also, of course, for the budget. And, you know, generally speaking, I think it depends governor to governor. But during my time on the fifth floor, it was really a division of labor. The budget is obviously the primary responsibility of the Secretary of Administration, something that you know about, Mike. And the State of the State tends to be a responsibility directly of the governor and his direct staff, which would include the Chief of Staff. But those two things really do intersect because obviously it's one full agenda and, you know, one set of priorities for a governor. So everybody works very closely together and trades ideas, works very closely with the governor to develop both of those pieces. And in many ways, those pieces flow from one another. Governor Shumlin often wanted to treat the speeches as really two parts. And I think that's pretty typical for other governors as well.
It is usually typical to keep those speeches separately, the budget and the State of the State address. How does the legislative agenda come? Not only do you have the budget, and the budget is a policy document. It has a lot of changes to laws and other things that are in there. But about other legislative agenda items, how does that come together?
Well, it's a iterative process, as they say. It goes back and forth between the legislature and the administration and the citizens of Vermont. I think that an advantage the governor has is that he tends to get around all over the state and talk to Vermonters throughout the entire year. In Vermont, of course, we have a part-time legislature, and so they bring their own experiences as well from their, you know, lines of work and family and communities. And I think that when you listen to Vermonters, you hear what their concerns are, and you start to realize where the areas of focus need to be. And the legislature brings that to their work. The governor brings that to his work. His cabinet brings it to their work, too. So really, looking at the priorities for the year, you can tick through the major issues, public safety, the economy, social services, energy. And you can think of where improvements could be made in all of those areas, but it starts first and foremost with what Vermonters want to see.
How many drafts of the speeches do you go through?
You know, I'd love to know the answer from you with Governor Douglas, but I think it really depends.
Okay.
Well, yeah. I think it really depends on the giver. Governor Shumlin is, I think, a gifted speaker and worked very hard to be personally involved in his speeches and make sure that they reflected very much his own priorities, his own language. And so it wasn't so much, you know, draft one, draft two, as it was capturing what it was he wanted to say and how he wanted to say it. And it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of back and forth, but really it has to be driven by the person who's going to be standing up there at the podium giving it.
We're speaking with Liz Miller, former Chief of Staff to Governor Shumlin. If you wish to join our conversation, the number to call in at our WDEV studios is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Was just wondering, out of all this that you go through, was there an event or a discovery that you remember that sort of put a fly in the ointment?
You know, I think things come up all the time. Just getting back to the sports analogy, you can have your playbook for the year, but if something comes at you, you have to react. whether it's a challenge from the other team or an injury on your own team or whatever it might be. So in state government, you have the rhythms of how the budget works and how the legislative priorities work and all of course, the day-to-day workings of the agencies. But in the end, you got to react to what's happening. So the one example that I think all Vermonters will very much understand and remember is Irene. Irene happened at the end of August, and as I mentioned, that's right in the beginning of the budget cycle. And so trying to work through that budget that year, I remember I was at public service at the time. That was an amazing challenge. And, you know, it was all hands on deck for lots of things throughout Vermont. It was definitely all hands on deck to make sure that despite that immense natural disaster, we had everything ready to go for the legislative session and a budget that reacted to the new situation that we found, which was Irene.
There'll be a new administration this time next year. And, of course, a transition is a busy, busy time. But given your experience, what advice would you give to the new administration?
I think there's two things, and I hope that everybody running would come to them naturally, frankly. One is you got to listen, and you have to listen to the folks who are in the job now. I remember my predecessor was incredibly helpful when I came into the job. That's not a partisan issue. You got to get the work of state government done. So listening very closely to those who've come before you, taking their advice, and then secondly, making sure you surround yourself with the best possible people. Because I didn't fully appreciate this when I came into state government from the private sector. It is a ton of work. It takes a lot of dedication and a lot of personal sacrifice. But you got to take the job just as seriously and with as much sense of responsibility as Vermonters would expect you to have. And so you really need to make sure you have a team who's fully on board with that. And I think if the new governor listens and has a team fully on board with the work of getting the hard work for Vermont done, he or she will be just fine.
We'll continue our conversation with Liz Miller, former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin, in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Joining us in our Radio Vermont studios is Liz Miller, former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin. We're talking about the fact that it's a busy time of year on the fifth floor, and the fifth floor is where the governor's office is located, along with the Secretary of Administration and the budget office. And we talked in the first part of this segment about those things that are going on, the budget, two speeches, legislative agenda, all those things that are happening now to get ready in the next few weeks for the upcoming legislative session. But I want to turn, Liz, to the job of chief of staff. And obviously you're not in that job anymore in the governor's office. But what surprised you about being a chief of staff?
It's an interesting question. I went in with so little preconceived notion of what it was supposed to be that I'm not sure surprise would be the right word. The first thing I'd say is I was pleasantly impressed with the quality of the people working in and around the governor, not just his direct appointees that he had brought with him, but also just the number of people on the fifth floor, and you'll probably remember some of them, Mike, yourself, who'd been there for years just doing amazingly hard and detailed work for state government. I think of, for example, Janice Carrier, who you probably remember, who ran the office for the governor both under, well, before Governor Douglas. She went back, I think, to Governor Kunin, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I don't know. I know she was with Howard.
Yeah. And then also people in the budget office, some of the analysts who'd been with the state for many, many years. And the level of expertise that they brought was something I was very impressed by and something I think I just hadn't expected coming in, not really understanding exactly how the budget process worked until I had to be directly involved in it.
What does a chief of staff do?
Well, it's a good question. I think a chief of staff needs to be to stand in the stead of her boss on any matter that he needs. And so day to day, that would mean running the office on the fifth floor. Governors need to be and are expected to be out in the public, meeting with Vermonters, attending events, listening to Vermonters. And that means that, things have to keep working back home, as it were. And the chief of staff's job is to make sure that that happens. So day to day, that would be the responsibility. And that's everything from helping to make sure that the testimony at the legislature is on track, working with secretaries and commissioners on their day-to-day work, interfacing with the Secretary of Administration on the budget work, but then making sure that you're in constant communication with the governor, because it's important to remember that you're standing in the stead of the governor for that day-to-day work. You're not the governor. You need to work very closely with him or her to make sure that the priorities the governor has comes through and the decision-making comes from the governor.
How does it stay all coordinated? I mean, it sounds like it's an orchestra that you're sort of conducting in this aspect. How do you stay coordinated?
You have to be very type A. No, I think for me it was a couple of things. First of all, constant communication. You know, I was on the phone all the time. It was attached to my head practically, making sure that I was letting the governor know what was going on, that I was communicating with the secretaries and commissioners and with everybody else on staff. And then I think for me, routine meetings, having some routine was important. So I would make sure that the agencies and departments that I most closely worked with, I had scheduled check-ins with them multiple times a week. I would have check-ins directly with the secretaries and commissioners a little less frequently, sometimes once a week or once every 2 weeks. But making sure that those sort of routine voice-to-voice check-ins occur, if not face-to-face and certainly on the phone, was a really important way to make sure the trains kept running on time.
We're speaking with Liz Miller, who is the former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin. We're talking about what it's like to be a chief of staff during a time that's very busy up on the fifth floor being the governor's office, secretary of administration's office, and the budget office. If you wish to join our conversations, call our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. It's a 24-hour-a-day job, 7 days a week. Did you realize that, or did that sort of surprise you?
I realized it when I came into the chief of staff job. I'd been doing the commissioner job for a couple of years, and even at that level, the cabinet level, you really need to be on call all the time. I mean, again, not Irene being the example, the utilities did a pretty amazing job actually recovering from that devastation, as we'll all recall. But you didn't have an option at 3 a.m., you know, the morning of that storm, besides being on the phone and communicating with AOT and with the governor's office. And that sort of thing is just what you have to expect when you take these jobs. And, you know, I think Vermonters need it and deserve it. And unfortunately, things come up. And if you're in charge, you got to make sure things happen.
Any 3:30 in the morning phone calls?
Oh, sure. That would occasionally come up. But, you know, it tends to be the sorts of issues where you have secretaries and commissioners or other people on staff who just want to make sure that you're involved, that you understand what's going on, whether it was usually a natural disaster situation, a weather situation, occasionally a public safety issue, those sorts of things.
You mentioned that the workload didn't surprise you, but was there anything that surprised you about being chief of staff?
You know, I had not been a particularly political person before joining state government. And while I have certainly followed politics closely and supported candidates and that sort of thing just as a personal matter, I think that it was surprising to me the bubble, the political bubble and the press and public scrutiny, just from a personal point of view, not something I had experienced before. It was incredibly interesting. I'm really glad I did it. But it's definitely a different way of life than I had been used to as a normal Vermonter.
And the one thing that I talk to a lot of people that leave state government, and there's different reactions after they leave state government. What if you had to sort of describe your feeling when you left state government, left a fairly high-powered job where you're at the center of attention? You don't want to be, but you are at the center of attention. How would you describe what you felt when you left?
I remember somebody going on a motorcycle trip for a few months, right?
That's right.
That's
what you did.
No, I didn't do that. I did my own version of that, I guess. you know, you're right that it's not so much that you're at the center of attention because, you know, typically staff on the fifth floor should recede into the background behind the governor. But you do tend to know what's going on, quote unquote, in the state. Stepping away from that, it actually does take some time to decompress. It's very interesting, and I hadn't really anticipated it. I think moving on back to private life meant that I had to think about myself and my own priorities again. And I had a great summer. I did some fishing, walked my dog, exercised a little bit, not much. Got to know my nephew. So I had a great summer, but it definitely took some time to decompress and get used to being a little bit more out of the flow.
A firefighter will describe that he misses the call, or he or she will miss the call and misses that excitement, that adrenaline rush. Other people describe that news people, for example, who leave the news business, feel that all of a sudden part of them has been detached because right. They know what's good. Did you have that same feeling?
You know, a little bit. I remember the one time I remember feeling that way was soon after I had left. Everyone will remember the very tense situation over in upstate New York when prisoners had escaped. And the Vermont State Police and other law enforcement agencies in Vermont got, of course, very involved with helping coordinate the search, both in New York and also being vigilant here in Vermont. And I remember sitting in my office at home and hearing that the governor was attending a press conference with Governor Cuomo. And I just had that moment of, oh my gosh, because I know that if I were on the fifth floor, the amount of coordination and effort and really just work that would go into that. And so I do remember at that time thinking, wow, I don't have to do anything. And I do have to say that it was more relief than anything else, especially knowing that everything was under control with good people working on the fifth floor. But I do remember that kind of funny sensation.
Any interest in politics yourself?
You know, no, not really. For years I've been involved at the local level and now at the state level. And in supporting people who run for office, I'm incredibly grateful that people want to do it, because we need them, and it's a lot of hard work. But I don't have any interest myself. I will continue to be very politically interested, but not personally politically involved, I believe.
We've been speaking with Liz Miller, who is the former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin. Thank you, Liz, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Happy to do so. Happy holidays and happy new year.
Same to you. Happy
Thank
holidays
you.
And happy new years. Coming up, a conversation with our colleague in Washington, D.C., Bob Ney, former congressman. But we're going to do a little twist on this. He's from Talk Media News. We're going to talk about him. He usually calls in on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we talk about what's happening in Congress. But today I want to talk about what he experienced in Congress when he was there, and of course his conviction and jail time for his involvement in the Aberoff scandal. And then later on, Lisa Grady of the Stowe Public Library, she'll be in studio and we'll talk about upcoming events at the library, at the Stowe Public Library. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith on our phone line this morning. Usually it's about congressional things that we're talking about, public policy at the Congress level, is Bob Ney. He's a former congressman, but you know him because he calls in on Talk Media News on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we usually talk about things happening in Washington. But I'm going to mix it up today, because what I want to talk about is his experiences in Congress and some of the events that he's been involved in his life. Good morning, Bob. Bob, are you there?
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Super.
Just wanted to I just explained to the audience that we're shaking things up a little bit. We're not going to be talking about specific congressional issues today. We're going to be talking about you.
And, sure.
And you came into Congress during sort of the Gingrich Revolution. What did you do before you were in Congress?
Well, I was a state representative, representative elected at 26 in Ohio to a, I think, a 3% Republican House seat, state rep seat. Then I went into the state Senate at 29, and actually my seat and one other flipped it over to the control of the Republicans in Ohio. So I was kind of thrust into the limelight there, became chairman of the Budget Committee, refused to run for Congress. They talked me into meeting for, quote, only 10 minutes with this Gingrich guy. So I said, fine, I'll do you a favor to the chairman of the party. I'll go to D.C., and I'm going to tell this guy no, because they're not going to turn this over in my lifetime. I don't want to be there, and I think Congress is a joke. So I flew out to Washington. My 10 minutes turned into 45 minutes, and I looked at Newt Gingrich and said, yes, of course I'll run.
What did he say that convinced you?
Well, this is the jackpot question, and I wrote about this in my book. The rest of the people that were lobbying me so heavy all the time, all the members of Congress, we can turn this over, because you see, the seat was about 13 or 14% Republican index. So my seat was impossible to win, and they thought I could, and they wanted this contract with America class, you know. Mm-hmm. And but the rest of them said, oh, you can be in Congress, you can make this money, you can make this higher salary, you can travel. And I'm like, look, I don't care about all of that. I could care less. I went out to meet with Gingrich, seriously, to tell him no as a favor to the chairman of the Republican Party. And he said, listen, we can reform America. We can change working for welfare. We can help people up the ladder. We can do this. We can do that. He didn't mention pensions. He didn't mention money. He didn't mention power. He said we can use power to help people. Then he turned to me and he said, listen, you have a seat we can't win. He said, my wife is from your area. He said, we can't win that seat technically. He said, we have 19 seats we can't win. If you tell me yes today, I have to find 18 other people to have a chance, a small window of opportunity to save this nation and to change the direction for future generations, including your grandkids. Are you in with me? And I said, yeah. That did it.
And what issues did you run on?
I didn't run with the contract with America, by the way. You know, I had a heavy, heavy, heavy Democratic seat, and we ran on, look what I did in the state Senate. We balanced the budget. We, you know, we were fair to people. We treated people in a fair manner. We did, you know, any constituent service for them. We battled for them. We stood up for steel and coal and manufacturing jobs. We stood up for working people of a decent living wage. And I know I sound like probably a Democratic side, but I hit heavy on that and the fact that I was chairman of the Budget Committee in Ohio, and unlike those fools in D.C. who spend your money, we actually had to live within a budget frame. Mm-hmm. And I ran on that.
And do you think being in politics at a young age, 26, of course, I was in the legislature at 22, but I didn't stay there. but do you think that being in politics sort of all your life is a good thing or a bad thing?
Now, I go on the side of it's a good thing. I know people, you know, career politicians, et cetera. I think it's a blend, and I still think it's the people, but I don't really have a problem with career politicians if they keep, you know, if they keep in touch with where they came from, you know, and you do have the chance to lose touch. I understand that very well, but I still think that it's not a bad thing. If you have people running in and out of the system all the time, and you know, they just really don't know what they're doing politically, they can be a nightmare too. So I think it's a balance. Now, I think people probably stay in too long, to be frank with you, but I think there's a balance. I've always been afraid of people who say, I'm running for office and I'm not a politician. I always think, whew, okay, politics is going to destroy you in about mm-hmm. 10 minutes.
Let's spend some time talking about your time in Congress and your rise in Congress. What surprised you, first of all, when you walked through those doors at the Capitol?
You know, I got the feeling about the Capitol, even the same day I left, which was not, I didn't leave in good way. I fell from grace, as you know. But I still get the thrill every time I walked in there of this being the greatest democracy on the face of Earth. You know, it's just an amazing place where history has lived. And so I got that thrill of it, but I also saw it as a place that could make change. Now, I'm a little bit jaded now, in a sense, not because of what happened to me, but I actually served in the Congress when we could put together bills that could never be passed in today's Congress, ever. Help America Vote Act, one of them, for example, that Steny Hoyer was on, and Dodd from your region of the world, and Mitch McConnell, the current, you know, leader of the Senate. So I saw it as not a destructive place. I saw it as a place where things could potentially change. And that was kind of the thrill that I got out of it.
What was your proudest accomplishment?
The Help America Vote Act. I authored that. That was my bill, and it changed the way American election systems operated. I took it off recommendations by Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, who both had called me after the passage of the act. That was a thrill for me. Of all the famous people I met on Earth, that those two phone calls back-to-back were a thrill from Carter and Ford. But I took that, and we changed the American election system to try to give some credibility back to it after the Gore Bush hanging pregnant and dimpled chads.
And so for
that was my legacy bill.
And for the listeners, what did that bill do?
Well, that's the bill that today when you vote, it modernized the election system. It computerized all elections across the U.S. Now, there's conspiracy theories that it helped fix George Bush's election. I can tell you, if I did that, I would not have spent time in his prison. So let me put that theory to rest. But the bill had great support. And what it did in a nutshell was to automate the computer systems across America for voting. You don't have to do it. It didn't mandate it. But if you did, there were incentives to get into it. You know, every state did. And then it created an elections commission, which I'm very proud cannot mandate a rule. It can't tell you in your neck of the woods that you're going to vote at this time of the day and you're going to have your lights turned on at that time of the day. It has no rulemaking authority power. But we created that for federal elections. And it has provisional voting. Up to that time, before we passed it, people would say, I was turned away because I was black, I was turned away because I was white, I was turned away because I was poor or Republican or Democrat, whatever. Now, you vote, no matter what. If they say, I happen to know you live in another state, you still vote, then if that vote is improper, it's shredded. If the vote is proper, it's counted. So nobody can really turn around today and say, I was disenfranchised. It stopped that. So those were some of the things that I think that were very good in the bill.
Bob, you had a rapid rise in Congress. How'd you do that?
Gingrich. My 30 days in, I will never forget Newt Gingrich calling me and saying, how would you like to be vice chairman of the House Administration Committee? You'll be the first member of this freshman class, you know, the famous contract class that made him speaker. You'll be the first sitting vice chairman, and I'm going to make you vice chairman of House Administration. I said, what about the sitting guy, Vern Ehlers from Michigan? Newt said, don't worry about that. I'm just asking you this question. And I said, yes. And he made me vice chairman of that committee in my first 30 days in office. Newt really took brand new members and just shuffled them around. And then I became chairman of House Administration, the first chairman out of that freshman class. And I oversaw federal election law, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, and most importantly, anything to do with the Capitol. You want drapes, you want your walls painted, you had to call me. And my district got a lot of highway money. I'm not going to tell you they didn't. So
we're speaking with Bob Ney, who's the former congressman, now calls in for Talk Media Radio, Talk Media News here on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You're familiar with his voice, you're familiar with him. But what we're talking about today is his life and his experiences in Congress. If you wish to join our conversation, the number to call us at our WDEV studios is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We're asking for phone calls today, which is a little bit different than what we normally do here. If you have a question, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Bob, how did it all go wrong for
well,
you?
Well, there's a bright line you cross, and some groups of people got together and said, you need to be Speaker of the House. You can be Speaker, and you need to be Speaker. And I said, okay. So we embarked on the course to make me Speaker. After Hastert would leave, we figured that there was the opportunity. And somewhere in between there is when we lost the the sight of the current job, and I lost it because, you know, look, it's my fault at the end of the day. But what happened was that I was not on the right side of a guy named Tom DeLay. I was one of his 13 deputy whips. I was in the leadership structure, but I just wasn't on the right side. I was a, quote, a squishy pro-union Republican. I believed in fair wages, and I believed in, you know, prevailing wage, et cetera. So we felt we had to neutralize Tom DeLay or would never make it because he had opposed me on another chairmanship. So somebody said, well, the way to get to DeLay is his best ever friend is the famous lobbyist Jack Abramoff. And that's where it started. And then my chief of staff left my office and went to work for Jack Abramoff, and that link it was a cross of the bright line on my part. And then we did a, quote, stream of favors for Jack Abramoff, including eating free at his restaurant. And that's what did it. I mean, the straw that broke the camel's back was a trip to Scotland, which other people took, and they just reimbursed their trip costs. But mine cost me, you know, a felony plea on filling out a form of the cost of the trip. So, but it was a crossing of the bright line. And look, my attitude was everybody else does it. You know, people go get free drinks or food, but it doesn't matter. And we crossed that line, and we had too much influence with Jack Abramoff, and that's what began the, you know, and I say in my book, I should have known better. You know, if something doesn't feel right, just stop yourself right there. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do that. So that's where it started.
And your book, of course, is Sideswiped, Lessons Learned, Courtesy of the Hitman of Capitol Hill. That title intrigued me. Why that title?
You're the only person that's ever asked this since 2013, by the way. Yeah. And it's because in the book, I admit what I did, just as I did now. Favors for Jack Abramoff, etc. So I admit it right out front, so it's not like the devil made me do it. But there were other delicacies and intricacies that were out there that the perfect storm came into play. So the hit... So I caused this, and when you get sideswiped, you get hit and broadsided, let's say, by somebody, sideswiped by somebody. But you could be at fault because maybe you were speeding in the car. That's how I picked the title. Mm-hmm. So I got sideswiped, but it was my fault, too, when I was driving that car. But there were some things that happened and people that capitalized on things. For example, John McCain hated Jack Abramoff because McCain felt he cost him his election against George Bush in a presidential primary. And by the way, Jack Abramoff did. He did that for Karl Rove. They nailed McCain early on. So once all this started, McCain sees that. McCain hated me because I had stopped his campaign finance bill the first time. So McCain sees that opportunity. He accepted money from Abramoff, campaign dollars. He was all full of influence, but he used that to then say, oh, I put Bob Ney and Jack Abramoff in jail. I'm going to run for president again. Look how clean I am. I get those big, bad lobbyists. Meanwhile, McCain's raking in all the money. So that was one of the side notes. And John Boehner, the outgoing speaker, sees the opportunity to, you know, that I went away. The Bush administration didn't have to worry about, you know, other people involved with Jack Abramoff. Look, Bush staffers were down at that bar. I used to have to almost push them away to get a drink at Jack's bar. So there's another... Hitman of Capitol Hill. So that's why I created the title. You know, I was at fault, but there were other people that also came into play on this thing, just like when you're sideswiped. Maybe there's two parties guilty.
Who else went down on this scandal in terms of jail time?
Me and Jack Abramoff. Me and Jack. The only other person that went down was a guy that fought him. Kevin Ring fought them. And also David Savavian, these are people that weren't office holders. They fought the government. And so Mike Scanlon, Jack's partner, there were five of us. The rest of the members of Congress that went on the golf trips, et cetera, were spared time. And almost all the staffers, well, all my staffers that pled guilty did a plea and were spared time. And the rest of the staff people on other sides of her, Jack's staff, were also spared time. But Kevin Ring fought them. Savavian fought them. They went to jail. Scanlon, they had no choice. Scanlon was deep into this, as Abramoff was. And then on the congressional side, I was the one on the congressional side.
And during the scandal, other than yourself, what were they doing that got them in trouble?
Well, Jack Abramoff had this bizarre deal with Ralph Reed. Remember the head of the Christian Coalition?
Mm-hmm.
And Grover Norquist with the tax reform people was involved a little bit, but Ralph Reed was up to his eye teeth in it. And what they did was Jack Abramoff went in. He had a tribe called the Tigwa Indian tribe he represented and made millions and millions and millions off of them and of getting them things in D.C. So the Tigwa wanted this license, and what Jack did was he had Ralph Reed oppose them, you know, the gambling's bad, et cetera. Then he went to the Tigwa tribe and said, hey, I can help you fight this thing, get you a special amendment, where he came to me. I never did the amendment, but he came to me and asked for an amendment. And then he and Ralph Reed, through Mike Scanlon, Jack's business partner, had this secret deal when they were making money. So I know it's confusing, but Jack had a secret partnership with Ralph Reed and Mike Scanlon. One hand, Ralph's going, hey, everybody, let's stop this Indian tribe from getting their gambling license. And on the other hand, Jack's like, hey, I can fight this Ralph Reed guy for you. Mm-hmm. So Jack and Ralph were making money both sides.
I was wondering why Ralph never got caught up in this.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, my opinion on this is that there is no way the Bush Justice Department under Gonzales, Alberto Gonzales, was going to go after the former head of the Christian Coalition and Tom DeLay from Texas, Bush's backyard, very powerful congressman, very tied to the Christian Coalition and conservative groups. No way under the sun. If Jack and I went away, it was all done. They were. John McCain didn't even call Ralph Reed for the committee. Ralph was in a secret business relationship. They had given Tom DeLay's chief of staff $1 million to a foundation, to a grant, Ed Buckham. None of those people were called. And the question I would pose to John McCain is, why didn't you call them? There was a documentary done by Alex Gibney called Casino Jack, the United States of Money, where Gibney and we had dinner together. I was in the documentary. He can't understand to this day how on earth they all escaped being drugged before McCain's committee. Only Abramoff and I think Scanlon were called, Abramoff's partner.
Later on, Tom DeLay was – there was a prosecution against Tom DeLay, but it didn't involve this?
Well, no, it was a Texas – it was a Texas court. You know, a lot of people made the speculation if a little court in Texas could get Tom DeLay convicted, which they did. It got overturned. The might of the Justice Department, had they decided to go after DeLay, probably could have convicted him, and they might have been able to get him to do a plea deal. I never went to trial. I did a plea deal. Mm-hmm. And if the government had put all its resources to DeLay, they might have been able to get a plea deal. He went on a trip to Scotland. He had staffers that made money, et cetera, off of this. So they might have been able to, and they might not have. It depends if you can hold out long enough, you know, if you have some legal money, if the case is not real, real solid. And in my case, they had a better case. I was running out of money. I was in full-blown alcoholism at that time. Now, I'm not blaming everything on alcoholism, but if you're in that full-blown cycle, after a while, you just don't care. And so there was a lot of other factors out there. But if the feds had went after Tom DeLay full force, they might have got something. They might not have, but the little Texas court did, and it was not upheld. It was thrown out. But he did have to resign off of all the bad publicity.
In a moment, we'll continue our conversation with Bob Ney, former congressman. We're talking about his life and his experiences in Congress and his conviction. And when we come back, I noticed from your book that you, I guess you would call a hatred for Boehner. We'll talk about that
okay.
when we come back. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Bob Ney, former congressman. Talks to us on Tuesdays and Thursdays from Talk Media News. Oftentimes what we were talking about is what is happening at the nation's capital, most in Washington, D.C. But today we're mixing things up a little bit. We're talking about his experiences in Congress and his conviction and in jail time for involvement in a scandal. Bob, in your book, I can only describe it, and maybe I'm describing it wrong, but you have I would describe it, and it's my description, a hatred for Boehner. Why?
Yeah, actually, it's not, it probably looks like a hatred. I don't like him. I've known him 30-some years, and, you know, he was always a backbench guy. I've never heard one single thing out of John Boehner's mouth ever in 30 years of, you know, this is the right thing to do, this is something to do for people. It was just always about a campaign contribution or, you know, the power of the situation or the party. There was never anything of a public policy nature. But, you know, I got along with him and everything. He's a great guy to go out and drink with. He really is. He's, you know, hilarious, et cetera. And then he rose into the ranks of the minority leader, and he had a staffer that was just so involved with my former staffer who became a lobbyist, Dave DeStefano. And they were just like the bosom buddies. And Barry Jackson's his name, who actually was number two to Karl Rove. He worked for Boehner. And Barry just kept, you know, taking members down, Republican members, if he thought that they were at least a tiny bit threat to John or they said something, he would go to the press and say things about them. They just were a couple of bad characters, and my staffer, Dave DeStefano, who used to work for me, and they were it was about lobbying and money and things like that. And then Boehner called me, and I stayed in the race despite all my ethical problems. And he called me, and I had just won the primary, which he wouldn't help me for. And that was okay. I got through it. And then he called me in, and he said, listen, I know, you know, you've lost a lot of money. You don't have a private business. You didn't come to Congress wealthy. If you get out now, he said to me on the phone, I will help you pay your legal defense fund. I'll help you raise money. You can put this all beside yourself. I'll get you a job that pays close to what you're making. Now just get out. But you only have 24 hours, and this offer is no good after 24 hours. So I called him back, and I said, John, you know, I'll get out. I'll announce. I'm not going to complete this election. He said, okay. I announced it. I couldn't get a return phone call from a janitor. And it ended up, within a short period of time, Alice Fisher, that worked for Alberto Gonzalez, they started, you know, they're going to indict me on 65 counts. I was losing the House. I was losing everything. He simply, strictly, right out front, lied to me. Then once I went down, Alice got her appointment, Alice Fisher, the number two at the Attorney General's office, who couldn't get an appointment. Why? She was so close to Tom DeLay's defense team. She was criticized publicly for not doing anything about Jack Abramoff by the Democratic side. So conveniently, when I went out of the way with no resources, no legal defense fund, no ability to keep my head above water, then I went away, Jack went away, and Alice Fisher got her appointment within 10 days through the Senate, and everybody was happy, and George Bush was okay. All the dealings of Karl Rove and Jack Abramoff were swept under the rug. And so, you know, Boehner, I can't have a lot of love in my heart for the guy because he was involved in this up to his eye teeth.
What were you eventually convicted for?
Two counts. One has now been found unconstitutional, 6-0. Because somebody else filed, I didn't. That was called honest services fraud. When they can't nail you for bribery, they'll nail you for honest services fraud. And it's basically not being upfront enough, you know, with the constituents and stream of services, you know, of doing writing letters for Jack Abramoff, et cetera. So that was under honest services fraud. I pled to that. The second one I pled to was falsification of a federal document. That's the most interesting one. It was actually a congressional internal document, but in this case we call it federal because Congress is federal. And that was the trip where I said I went to Scotland with Jack Abramoff. Now, if I had never filed for the trip, which a lot of members never file a trip, this is interesting, I could never have been convicted of it. But I pled that we put down a false figure, which the figure is false. We pledged, I think, the staff said it was $3,700 in the trip. We don't even know how much it cost to this day, maybe $10,000, $15,000, I don't know. And so it was falsification of a federal document. So those are the two things that I pled to.
Why did you do the trip?
That's the greatest, and I'm laughing because I don't golf. And I had a staffer who the government threatened. His name's Matt Parker. And they said to him, you know, what do you know? And he said, I saw the congressman twice say, I will not go if this involves golf, because I loathed golf. And it was to Scotland. And so my other two staffers are like, well, let's go, and we'll go with you. So I did actually take them. So Matt told the government that twice, and finally they said, we're going to put you in prison. He said, put me in prison. And $45,000 later, they let Matt go. But Matt was witness to the fact that I didn't go for that reason. So I want to dispel the government's theory that I asked for that trip to go golf. I didn't, to Scotland, to St. Andrews. I went to have a good time, get to know Jack Abramoff, get cozy with him, he could help me become speaker, and drink.
This is a good segue. You have mentioned in your book, and you mentioned here, that you battled alcoholism. And as many know, alcoholism is a disease that not only affects the individual but affects others. You know, I talk from personal experience. My father drank himself to death. You know, from the disease. How did it impact you, and how did you overcome it?
Well, I haven't had my last drink. My sobriety date is September the 13th, 2006. And I've never relapsed, never had a drink. And this is why I can tell you I don't hate Boehner. I don't like him. I don't respect him. Everything I feel is factually accurate, what I said in the book. But actually, me going under is probably the only thing that kept me alive, because then I went to prison. I went to rehab. I had to confront going to rehab. Alan Ratner confronted me. Your Alan, my Alan. Mm-hmm. Confronted me, and I went to rehab, and then I got the help I needed. But I did a 12-step program, which I still do to this day, which are weekly 12-step meetings, and got a sponsor and did all the things I was supposed to do, and that's how I do it. And then now I sponsor people myself, about five or six people. But I did it through rehab, and I did it through but rehab's not enough. You have to go to 12-step recovery meetings. You have to follow the simple plan that's out there. And so that's how I did it. And I did it for myself. I don't subscribe to the theory that, you know, I love my children, I have to do it for my children. Well, when you drank, you probably loved your children too, you know, so you have to do it for yourself. So I bought into the 12-step recovery program, and that's how I did it.
And usually alcoholism, or at least in my experience, alcoholism has this devastating effect, not only on the individual, but it sends everybody else into a downward spiral as well, everybody that is associated with the alcoholic. Did you have that experience as well?
I am lucky. I mean, for the most part, things could have been better, no question, but my children came out okay out of it, and they'll tell you they did, but, you know, there's still collateral damage. I don't care. It could have been so much better. But I know horrific cases of people losing their home and losing this and that. So, you know, I think I could have been a much better, you know, dad if I hadn't, obviously, if I hadn't drank. But I am fortunate that, you know, that the kids are okay. I'm just lucky.
I'm going to go to the phone lines, Bob. After we jump back, I'm going to ask you, what did jail time teach you? But let's go to the phone lines and talk to Fred from Newberry. Fred, you're on Open Mic.
Yeah, I was in the restaurant service business, and there was a lot of foreign nationals that I'd do business with. And one of my favorite questions was, well, you know, before you came to the United States, what was your impression of the United States? And then when you got to the United States, what was the big thing that hit you in the face about the United States? Everybody said, there's no corruption in the United States. And that was, she was comparing it to the countries that they were coming from. And when you really look at it, there really isn't much corruption in the United States, is there?
Bob?
Well, in comparison to other countries, I don't think.
That's right. You're 100% right. Because, like, for instance, this was the, she's talking about perverse, broad-based corruption. The corruption that we see, basically, is the big stuff. But even the small stuff, you don't see it. Like, for instance, this woman, she called, the fire department came in to arrest her and said, you have to get this place cleaned up because it's too dirty as the fire has, right? And then she said, how do I do it? He said, you know, go to the phone book and you'll find somebody, right? And then I'll come back and look it over. So sure enough, he came back, looked it over. And then she said, I gave him a $20 bill and he refused to take it. And she said, I was just, you know, amazed that that was happened. And then she said, when I made an appointment with your company, you said you'd be here at X time and it was going to cost that much money. And then when you got here, you were here at the same time, and it cost the same money. You didn't have your hand out for extra.
Thanks, Fred, for the phone call. Bob, what is there rampant corruption?
I love this caller's. This is one of the best calls I've heard in years. I love this caller's call. I'm not putting down, you know, what we did is light, et cetera. But if you compare us, I mean, I had a vertigo attack last week. The fire department had to come 3:30 in the morning, okay, and get me. When I tried to get my antivert, my wallet had spilled. When I came back, my money was still laying on the floor of my apartment. I mean, yeah, In another country, the people picking you up might have taken the money. And I'm not trying to say other people are bad, but corruption is rampant around so many parts of the world. Just to get your mail, you have to pay a bribe in some countries. And so us, I mean, you know, Abramoff affair and other things that happen, or we hear about things and we say, oh, my, this is terrible. And I'm not downplaying what I did or what does happen. But I must say, if you compare us to the rest of the world, we keep after it, I think, pretty good.
Running out of time here, but I got a couple questions I just want to get to before we leave here. Jail time. You did about a year. What did it teach you?
Well, I mean, it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about myself and made me appreciate so many things. But of all the things, it taught me that, you know, I was the guy who said, just, you know, lock them up, these drug dealers, and throw away the key. And I went to prison, and forget the white collar. I always say the white collar crime guys, they were so whiny. I lost my house in Aspen, you know, really whiny people. But the drug dealers, 78% of the people I was in were, quote, drug dealers. There's a lot of addicts in there, and we warehouse these people. And there is another way to do that. This is not all the Medellin drug cartel in these prisons. These are addicts that are, quote, statistically the big-time drug dealers, and they aren't necessarily that. And so it taught me that we do warehouse. Now, if we choose to warehouse as a country people, then we will pay $55,000 per prisoner, and we'll warehouse them. Or we can take a different angle when it comes to drug addiction and rehab for a lot of people within the prison system, or maybe before they get there. And also there's, you know, a lot missing in the fabric of our society. We incarcerate more people than anywhere on earth, not statistically per capita. We incarcerate more than anywhere on earth. There is a reason for that. And so we've got to look at some of those problems, I think, that cause that.
Bob, we hear you Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we hear you talking about what's happening in Washington. But what are you doing now besides talking with us on Tuesdays and Thursdays?
I do a marathon run on Tuesdays and Thursdays for Ellen Radner, but I'm writing a second book, which is dealing with recovery, by the way, and kind of outside the box ways to deal with recovering from a lot of things, alcohol and maybe anger and other addictions people might have. I do that. I spend a lot of my time sponsoring people. I have four grandkids, the fifth on the way, and I work out every day because I went in prison at a huge 234 pounds, standing 5'8". I'm now 163 pounds. that's what I do. And plus, my parents are alive. They're 92, and they have some health issues, so I commute every weekend down to their house. Some people say that I'm semi-retired. I think I might run for Congress just to get a break.
Bob's book is Sideswiped, Lessons Learned, courtesy of the hitman of Capitol Hill. And I urge you to read it if you haven't so far. Bob, thank you very much for doing this. I've been wanting to do this for a while, and I appreciate the time that you and the honesty that you've brought to my show.
Thank you.
That's Bob Ney, former congressman, and you're familiar with him on Tuesdays and Thursdays when he calls in. Up next, Lisa Grady of the Stowe Public Library. She'll be in studio with us, and we'll be talking about upcoming events at the library. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Joining us in our Radio Vermont studios is Lisa Grady of the Stowe Free Library. And we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on at the Stowe Free Library. And by the way, there's a lot going on at the Stowe Free Library. Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
Good morning. Good. It's nice to put a face with the name.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. Exciting lineup for the Stowe Free Library. Can you explain what's coming up?
Oh, sure. Thanks. And you've taken a great interest, so I thank you for that. First of all, our series is titled In Our Own Backyard. And it runs from October through April. And outside of April, the other program that I'm in charge of is the annual meeting for the Friends of the Stowe Free Library. I booked December, January, I have two in February, March, April, and then, of course, in May is the annual meeting. Coming up in January, and I know you have an interview with him, January 14th, we're going to be having Howard Frank Mosher talking about his latest book, God's Kingdom. Were you able to line up that interview yet?
We'll get to that.
You'll get to that. Okay, great. And I'm looking forward to meeting him. This has been about a year that I've been hoping to get him to the library. I just finished reading his book. I've read so many of them. So I'm excited to have him coming in as a speaker.
And just let me back up a little bit. You had Ellen Stimson on at your library a few weeks ago, I think.
A few weeks ago, and you did a great interview with her. And I'm fairly certain that because of your interview, we had maybe about 30 there. And we had a lot to compete with in Stowe for that weekend. We had, that was the opening of the Christmas weekend. We had the Stowe Dickens play that was opening that night, and I thought, oh great, we're going to be sitting here to an empty room, but we didn't. We had 30 people.
She's a funny lady.
She was, and she loved you. She told the audience you were the best interview she has ever had.
Well, that's very kind of her. Yeah,
she was great.
You have Howard Frank Mosier on January 14th.
Yes, on February 11th, I have Jan Reynolds, who wrote a book called High Altitude Woman, and Jan is from Stowe, and the book is fascinating. It talks about her expeditions through Mount Everest. It talks about the differences between male and female strengths, especially since she's been on all male expeditions, and she talks about what she brings to the equation.
And she's quite a noted a high altitude climber.
She is.
Yeah.
She is. And so I know she's been in Stowe in the past, but not since I moved there. And so I'm looking forward to meeting her, too. And actually, in February, I have two booked, and that's a rarity. That's a first time for me. And on February 25th, we have a program I'm calling the Armchair Traveler. We're going to be having Marco Scabagnini, who is a, he's written for food and wine magazines. He is a tour guide for a very small outfit based out of Barrie called Cultural Crossroads. And he's going to be exploring regions of Italy through wine and olive oil tasting. And that'll be different. That'll be different. So looking forward to
I'll
that.
I'll take the wine. I'll leave the olive oil tasting.
Yeah, I'm wondering how this is going to go. But it's, by the way, with this series, we always have light refreshments afterwards. And we have some great bakers in Stowe. So come for the food, too. On March 3rd, Charlie Nardozzi is going to be presenting his latest book, Foodscaping. And Charlie has been with me since the beginning of our series, probably, I think this is our sixth year. And every year, the room is packed. Last year, he did something completely different, and he came in and he did a guided meditation with us, which is another one of Charlie's passions. So Gardening Guru, Charlie Nardozzi on March 3rd. On April 7th, I have Chris Rimmel from the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, and he's going to be presenting Bicknell's Thrush of Mount Mansfield. And then in May, again, that's our annual meeting, and that's during an afternoon. Starts around 4 o'clock. Sabre Field, the Vermont artist, is coming, and there is a man out of Dartmouth who has done a documentary on her. So we're going to be showing the documentary. She'll be there for questions and answers, and that should be very interesting.
This is very exciting stuff. Is this the wave of the future for libraries to bring in these authors? I find it fascinating because you used to go to the library after school and do your homework.
And you couldn't talk. You had to whisper.
You couldn't talk and you had to whisper. But this is totally different.
It is. It is. And I think it's a great way to bring community and relevancy to the library. I developed this series through the wintertime because I felt that it was important to bring people from the community who might not have any other opportunities, and a free opportunity at that, to get together, to meet, to hear an interesting topic, and to not be sitting or feeling like they're shut in their houses through the wintertime.
What's interesting to me, actually, this question popped into my head. What is your background? How do you come up with this, with these sort of exciting things?
Well, first off, I'm a volunteer for the library. I sit on the board for the Friends. And how do I tell this story? I moved up here 9 years ago, and I left behind a corporate job, and I left behind nonprofit work that I loved, that I did on top of my full-time job. And I had booked a concert series and a gardening series for this place called the Old Meeting House. And I came up here with an expert skier to Stowe, and I don't ski. So I needed to find my tribe. It wasn't sports. And it took me about a year, but I found it through the library, and I found it through the friends, because they were starting up. They were doing a plant sale at the time, and I thought, I'd love to garden. This is a great way to be involved. And then from there, one thing led to another. The librarian at the time was from that small part of New Hampshire that I had come from, in the Monadnock region, and she had been to one of my programs, Small World. And she said, wow, it'd be great if you could do that here. And I thought, yeah, okay, this is great. And they gave me a very small budget to work with. We offer our speakers an honorarium. Most take it, but a lot of the authors don't. Judd Hale gave his donation to the Jimmy Fund. Reeve Lindberg doesn't take the donation that we offer. So I've been doing it now for 6 years, and I love it. And I feel that it brings value to the library, and I feel that it brings value to the people who attend.
Many will say that the libraries are sort of old-fashioned because you have the internet nowadays, you can do various things. I don't agree with it, but some will say that. How do you stay relevant in today's? Obviously, this is one way.
Right. And we have other programs going on, too. We have programs for children, which is an opportunity for mothers in the area to get together, especially new people coming into the area that don't maybe have an opportunity to or a place to meet up with other mothers. We have computers at the library, too, and a lot of people from all over come to use the computers there to look for jobs, to do research on a project. It's great for kids coming to do their homework. There's a wonderful little children's section that I'm now discovering that I have a grandchild. And we're looking into ways to expand. There was a great program that the state just offered for libraries, and a lot of interesting people came together with great ideas about what they're doing to bring relevancy to their library. Music, interesting children's programs. There's a library out there that's doing talks like I do, but they do it at pubs or different restaurants on a Sunday afternoon, which then creates business for the pubs, too. So I think that's an idea I'd like to try.
It is fascinating what you're doing in Stowe. Can you just sort of repeat the dates that you have and the authors that you have coming in?
Sure. Again, it's 7 to 8. It's on a Thursday evening, and it's free to the public with light refreshments. January 14th is Howard Mosher talking about his new book, God's Kingdom. And I think he's doing a presentation on how to write fiction. Where does fiction come from? February 11th is Jan Reynolds, who will be talking about her book, High Altitude Woman. February 25th is food and wine writer Marco Scapagnini, who's going to be talking about exploring regions of Italy through wine and olive oil tasting. On March 3rd, we have Charlie Nardozzi presenting his latest book, Foodscaping. On April 7th, we have Chris Rimmel of Vermont Center for Eco Studies presenting Bicknell's Thrush of Mount Mansfield. And in May, we have artist Sabra Field coming to the annual Friends meeting.
Hey, Lisa, thank you so much for
thank
coming.
Thank you, too. Can I point everybody to the Facebook page?
Sure, please.
Facebook page for Stowe Library. Please like our Facebook page. And you can also go to stowelibrary.org. Or you can call them at 253-6145 for more information.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It wasn't that bad, was it?
No, it wasn't. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I want to thank our guests today, Liz Miller, former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin, Bob Ney, former congressman, now a call-in host and host of his own radio program. We talked a little bit about his experiences in Congress and his conviction in jail time he spent for a bribery scandal. And, of course, Lisa Grady from the Stowe Free Library. And what wonderful upcoming events are coming to that library in the winter and spring. Tomorrow on Open Mic, Matt Cota of the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association will be talking about the carbon tax, and former Governor Jim Douglas in studio. We'll talk about a little bit about what we did with Liz Miller today, following up on what it is to be like, what it is that's happening at the governor's office this time of year. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM, Island Pond, and, of course, streaming worldwide at wdevradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.